and then you have kids and then they make friends and then you're like, oh, I'm still in Texas and I'm 42. So.
Wow. This is my life.
I was like, I guess this is it. So hopefully when my kids are older, we will.
I will tell you, like, I'm a New Yorker and I live here in South Florida. It's actually funny. We both live in one of the only states in the United States where you can actually be a free American. But anyway, it's true.
Like in the two best states of the U.S.
Florida, I mean, it's kind of true. Like, you can do whatever the fuck you want to do in Texas and Florida. Like, no one cares. It's awesome. But as a New Yorker, like, I grew up there for over 20 years, and it's like I still am like a New Yorker in Florida. You know, I'm like. When people are nice to me, I'm like, what is wrong with you?
I get that. When I go to New York, I'm like, why is everyone so mean?
It's because we don't trust anybody, you know? And it's like when you're nice to somebody, like we start to ask questions. But the cool thing, though, is I feel that each environment that we're raised in gives us another tool to our basket. You know, I know that you're a writer and you've had your own journey, especially through your life. But I feel in many ways that Texas has a big part of it because that's where that journey took place and became a part of your life.
That's true.
You want to elaborate on that?
Sure. Texas, man. Okay. Well,
yay.
It was interesting because I grew up in Amarillo, which is in the Panhandle. Mm-hmm. And that
near Oklahoma.
Yeah. Like the top little square part, cube, whatever that is, you know. It is very conservative and is very religious. Like every corner, street corner has a gas station and a church. Like there is just that, you know, that's what I grew up in. And so everybody that I know that I grew up in that area, everybody that moved away, most of them became liberal, became like the opposite of Amarillo. But then everyone that stayed like that. And so it's really fascinating because like we got out of the world, out of that world, and we're like, oh, this is not what the world is like, you know, and I went from Amarillo to Austin, which is the, you know, there are a couple liberal little pockets in Texas, Austin being one of them. And so I was able to, like, I guess, open up my worldview a little bit. Yeah. But, you know, I think a lot of people view Texas as this horrible conservative state, and it is. There's terrible things our government is doing, but there are a lot of people who disagree with it here.
Same thing in Florida. We have a horrible governor. His name is Rob DeSantis. I mean, he's such a terrible governor.
He's the worst.
The worst. And like people are like, oh my God, Rob DeSantis is it? I'm like, dude, I live here in South Florida. Okay, we're in the blue bubble in Florida. A lot of the rest of Florida is shit. It's bad. Like even over here, it's like getting very expensive, very congested because nobody else wants to live anywhere else. They all want to come here or go to Naples or Fort Myers. You know, like where you're living, people aren't even going to San Antonio or Austin.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, or people are going to Houston or Dallas. Like nobody wants the fuck to go to like Corpus Christi or somewhere like that and have somebody going like, holy bejesus, you gotta have the Lord save you. Like, what the hell? You can't live a life. You can't be a free Muslim. You can't be a free Jew. You can't be a free Hindu. You can't think and be freely of yourself. It's just not possible.
Yeah. So thankfully living in the big cities, I don't feel that oppression that often unless I start to really think about it, you know, when I have friends who have trans children. And then I think about, oh, what's their life? Like how dangerous of a life they're living, or, you know, and I have daughters and I'm like, what if they get raped and get pregnant and they can't do anything? You know, it's like, then I guess it hasn't hit me personally, I guess, all of that stuff.
No,
but it is there and it is terrible.
But for you though, in a way is observance. Because you, thing about you is that when you're a writer, right, you have generally like a visual perspective where, you know, you're going through life and when you're writing, you have like information that you're putting together. you have this ability to observe these scenarios, these people living their lives, dealing with these situations, and you're able to like, wow, like that's how they're dealing with that situation, you know, because of their faith or because of their religion or whatever it may be.
Right. Yeah. That is definitely what I do. Like I've been studying people my whole life because I've always felt different. And so I've always just been like watching people like, why do people do what they do? Because I've never felt like one of them, you know? I've always just felt like over here and I'm just watching.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I knew somebody. I grew up in a ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in New York. And not in the city. I grew up on upstate. It's called Muncie. And the type of I wasn't raised like the strictest part. I was raised Orthodox. But a lot of us that leave the community were very fucked up. And unfortunately, most of them that leave, they don't live normal lives.
Yeah.
But I remember there was one person that I met that she was trans. And she left the community and she started transitioning in her mid-20s. And the crazy part is, I met her 3 times and I had no idea she was trans until like the third time. And I was like, oh, cool. Okay. And like, I just walked away from that. I was like, great, you know? But it's like to that point where I could sit there with somebody that went through something that I went through and was not only able to pick themselves up, but was able to make their own life for themselves.
Yeah, and they're able to like really own who they are. And like, it's brave as it is, but then to come from an environment like that, yeah, she's a badass.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's all about not necessarily being a strong person, but it's agility and the ability to understand what you want from your life. You know, it's like, do you really want to be here, or do you want maybe something a little better? You know, you got to push yourself just a little bit.
Yeah. I feel that that's been something that's driven me my whole life. It's just like, I want, and sometimes it feels unhealthy, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's great, but it's like, I'm always like, well, how can I be just a little bit better? but then I see, and sometimes I'm like, can I just be calm and happy with where I'm at? And that's kind of what I'm working on now. I think that actually is the better right now. But I see a lot of people who are just like stuck and unhappy, and they've been stuck and unhappy for, you know, 10 years, but then they don't actually like do anything with it. You know, they don't go to therapy or like make new choices, you know, just keep living the life that they hate.
The thing is, it's easier to be comfortable.
Yeah.
It's always easier to be comfortable. You know, it's like, I don't want to get out of the couch. I want to stay in the couch. I don't want to think for myself. I'm going to let somebody else think for me.
Yeah. That's definitely what I was thinking just an hour ago when I was like, why did I schedule something at 9 a.m.? But I was like, my bed is so comfortable.
You know, but honestly, it's a good point because podcasting is a great example of this. And I want to just touch also on, like, for example, with your writing in just a minute. But this is a great example of taking yourself to the uncomfortable zone. Mm-hmm. If you would have came to me 3 years ago before I started podcasting and said, get up in front of a microphone and have an hour-long conversation with somebody, I would tell you are fucking crazy. Get the hell out. I can't do that. And I couldn't do it at the beginning. It took a while until I was able to figure things out. It's the same thing where, like, takes a minute to get out of bed, you know, to get mind clear. And then, like, don't be hard on yourself. You know, it's like one of those things where when you're doing, like, writing or you're doing podcasting or you're in that creative zone, it's a slow process. It's not a fucking, you know, Sylvester Stallone movie. You know, within an hour, like, your life is great and amazing.
Well, you know what I found too, when I started doing things like podcasts and especially when I started doing like videos on my website, at first it was so hard. And it was like the idea of being able to like put myself out there like that was terrifying. But then I would watch them back And I would be like, hey, I'm not so bad after all. Look, I can, like, I always feel like I'm speaking a foreign language to people. You know, like I said, I always felt different. And I always feel misunderstood by people. And so I just always assumed that when I'm talking, I'm not making sense, because that's just what it feels like. And it turns out I'm autistic, and that's why.
I'm dyslexic, so you're preaching to the choir, honey.
and I watch myself, and I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I'm making sense, and I'm actually really smart here, and I'm maybe I'm good at this. And it was kind of, it's fascinating. But to get over that vulnerability, and that still creeps in. I'm like, ooh, I put something out there that was like really intense and really personal, but.
I think that's how you help people. No, you're right. It really is a great way of helping people. And it's a really great way of like tying back to getting out of your comfort zone. Like I had last night, you know, I do a segment with my best friend, Carissa, and she had a really, really rough day. And I was like, honey, we got to do the podcast because I got to talk to Cindy tomorrow. And she's like, I'm so tired. I'm like, honey. And we did the episode, and like for the first 20 minutes, it was just a drag. You know, because we were both just completely. But here's the thing, you know, when I know you recently wrote a book, like when you're writing that book, I can tell you, like, especially when I'm reading a book, when you get to like the last three or four chapters, I'm like, oh my God. Okay. All right. Are we there yet? Hello. Okay. All right. I want to know the ending. You know, it's like, come on. Yeah.
You can't sleep and you're staying up late.
Right.
Just got to finish it.
Exactly. And it's always those last or two or three chapters. But then once you get into that, it just goes right by. And you're like, okay, I got this. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to get through this. We managed to get through the hour, but it was it was an experience.
Well, I'm glad y'all made it through. Just be like, no, I'm out. I'm not doing this today. But
yeah, I'm gonna.
But often it makes me feel better, because actually, like a good conversation with someone when it's not just small talk is actually very energizing. If we were just small talking, I would be.
Actually, I have found even when I'm very tired, sometimes just staying up and just talking with people or just jamming out, because if you can tell, I play guitar, and. Yeah. I don't know. It's just like it's a way of like getting brain juice flowing.
Indeed.
Is that a good way of calling it?
Yeah, that makes complete sense to me. Brain juice flowing.
Brain juice. Okay. So, I mean, I've been talking about books, and I know that you're a writer, and I remember because we actually tried scheduling this interview several months ago, and I remember at that point you were telling me that you were working on one of your books and you were getting it published. Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah.
So I'm actually curious.
Yeah. So I wrote a book. It came out October 31st and it is called Art is About Being Whole, a memoir. And obviously it's a memoir. And each chapter is an artwork that I interpret to also tell my story. So my life, I've been an art teacher, a museum educator, and I've been for the last 10 years running a business for art teachers, helping them connect their students to works of art. And so, but I've always had this like really intense passion for looking at art, and like more than just, I don't really care about learning about the history of it or all of that. I mean, I do care, but just not as much. It's more about like what it personally does for me and like the emotions it brings up and all of that. And so that's what I do in the book, is I incorporate works of art, not as a way to teach about the works of art, but as a way to use them as a metaphor for whatever I'm going through. So like there's a chapter on shame and the shame I was experiencing at that time in my life. And I use a painting by Frida Kahlo, and it's called The Two Fridas, and there's two Fridas.
Hey, it's Dave, and I quickly just wanted to jump in and say, if you've been enjoying the podcast and enjoying this episode, if you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that'll be so greatly appreciated. Because here's the thing, someone might read that review and make the choice if they want to listen to the podcast. You get to help grow this podcast with us. How fucking cool is that? Let's jump back to today's episode.
one is kind of looks like she's in a lot of pain and one looks more healthy and they're like connected with a blood vessel. And so I use that as like sort of the, like the shameful version of me and the part of me that like is pulling myself along, like out of that shame. And so each chapter, you know, is like that. There's an artwork that I interpret, but by the end of it, I'm making my own art and I include my own art in the book, as well. Because I started making art again since I hadn't made art in a really, really long time since I was a kid and started about 2 years ago making art again. There's also poetry in the book, so that happened too somehow. I hadn't written poetry since I was a kid either.
That's really cool. Yeah. I like that. I can relate to a certain degree. Like, I'm an artist myself. I haven't really drawn or made anything in like 4 years. This is like 2020. It's hard. You know, you get into a certain place, but I think, you know, that's really cool though. When you're able to make a piece of literature, like a book that not only represents art, but also represents poetry. And you have this kind of collaboration of, you know, what is the art representing and what can it represent? You know, what could you interpret? You're right. A lot, I'll be honest, I like to call art history bouge, because whenever somebody's like, oh, that's a Van Gogh, I'm like, oh, okay. It's like, that's a Van Gogh. You know, that's Picasso. I'm like, all right, cool. It's like, that's nice. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, but they're just people.
Yes.
You know, it's like Leonardo da Vinci, he was just a person. And if people are like, oh, it's like, hey, calm down. It's okay.
It becomes about like the prestige of it and like the, like what some white guy said was the best art. And, but like, why do you go to the Louvre and you see the Mona Lisa in a room by itself covered in glass and then like 50 people all in the room and you can't even see it, when there's like so many other things there that like might be more interesting to you, but you're just, I have to see the famous one. And then I have to like sound smart when I'm talking about it. And I have to be a certain way. I have to be smart. I have to be cultured and I have to show that I'm smart and cultured, but really like, that's not what art is about. And that's never what it's been about for me. And so that's what I try to show in my book, is like that art is about something else. It's not about like being a better person or being a cultured person, or there's so many people with all these art wounds walking around that feel like they're less than the art that's out there, and that art is not for them because they're lacking something. Mm-hmm. When really like they're just looking at the wrong art and they're not opening themselves up to the experience.
No, they're not. You know, one of my favorite artists is David Bowie. And a little thing that a lot of people don't know about him, he was an artist. He was a mural artist. He painted a lot of natural. He was very inspired by African culture and color mm-hmm. schemes. He loved creating like these very natural pieces. And what I always loved is just, if you ever just want a good, like, listen, just hear David Bowie talk about when he makes his art. He, like, never mentions about, oh, I was inspired by this person. He's like, I saw this rock, you know, or I heard this poem. And, like, I wanted to put this color and that. And I'm like, there you go. That kind of represents something that you kind of put together and you, like, it looks like shit. But that's besides the point.
Well, and that's too, like, I had studied my whole life art, like my degree was in art history. I worked in museums. You know, I have this whole website dedicated to other people's art and helping teachers teach other people's art. And somehow in my life, I used to make art as a kid. And then I've developed this story in myself that you couldn't, to be an artist, you had to have a good idea about what it should look like. And then you have to implement that idea. And then you have to do it perfectly the first time. And
false,
I was like, well,
I
don't have ideas like that. That's not how my creativity works. I don't plan anything. Like, I don't I would cook a recipe. I don't use a recipe. I like just start cooking. Or like if I go travel somewhere, I don't read a guidebook. I just show up and I'm like, well, what am I going to do here? You know? And why did I think that my art had to be something different? And then when I started dismantling that idea of like, well, why don't I just show up at the art and just like do whatever feels right? And turns out that's how I make art. And that's how a lot of, that's how probably most artists make art. They might start with an initial idea, but then they just kind of let it happen organically while they're making it. And so once I released that story of like what art had to be, that was really a game changer. And I was able to actually make art again and feel good about it.
See, that is an example of, for, you know, a positive outlook. You were able to create something that you were proud of, even, you know, with your experience in the past, you know, helping other artists and being a part of their experiences. But you were able to make something not only for yourself, but something that's interactive and intuitive and doesn't need one interpretation. I'm sure if you had five people, you know, at a book signing, right? And you ask them, what did they take from your book? I don't think you're going to get the same answer from each person.
Yeah, you're not. Have you ever read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert?
Maybe. Let me.
Oh, it's so good. I've read it many. It's like one of those I've read multiple times. But she tells a story because she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, that, you know, and that was like a blockbuster. And she tells a story of how someone came up to her and was just like, you know, I left my husband after I read the story of such and such. And she was like, that was not in the book. Like, I did not write that story is not there. That didn't happen in my life. Like, this person had just totally added their own story into her book because they saw themselves in it so much that they just like remembered they read something that they didn't actually read, which is fascinating.
Yeah, I know this author. Oh, okay. Are you serious? They're just like, I'm going to just type up a few extra pages.
No, they just like remembered it that way. So, but I think that's what has been really exciting for me, is because my book is, it's personal. It's a memoir. It's not like a self-help book or any, you know, it's not anything like that. But people, I've gotten so many comments. They're like, I saw myself in it and I learned about myself through it. And that is really exciting to me, because like I said, you know, for most of my life I have felt different, and for other people like to read it and then see themselves in me, and like they felt different too, but then they found, you know, they found themselves in something that I created. And I think that's really my whole, like, what I've been trying to do. Like, I think that's my whole reason for writing and reason for making art, is to, really anything I do is to, like, I just have this need to express myself, and it's just like I have to do it. And
do you know why, this is my view, do you know why artists exist in our universe?
Because they're human.
It's more than that.
Humans have a need to connect with other humans.
For sure. But I think also there's also a deeper layer to it, where just like the universe is constantly creating new planets, new stars, new solar systems, new galaxies. Creation is baked within this infinite universe that we live in.
Yeah.
And I feel that the more we steer away from creativity, this is going to sound stupid, but a great example of it is go out and look at the cars on the road.
Yeah.
It's the most boringest scene you've ever seen in your entire life. Everyone has a white Toyota Camry, a gray Toyota Sienna, a Honda Accord that's black. Everybody, like, it's just boring, you know? And even architecture to the boring. There's no creativity. Yeah. There's no life. It's like, ugh, it's just white walls, white floor.
Oh yeah. When I bought this house, it was new construction. Everything was gray. And I was like, everything is gray in this house. Like, I cannot deal with how much gray is in this house. But I do think too, though, I mean, to counter that, though, I do agree with you that to counter that, though, I think a lot of the creative energy of humans right now is dedicated to innovation. It's to technology too. Like that is creativity too. It's just, it is creation.
Different form.
It is, yeah. And so like, while the cars are all white, like now they drive themselves, or, you know, they stay in the lane and then they like are really comfortable, you know? So it's like, there is a lot of
setbacks,
creativity and innovation, but maybe not like aesthetically exciting.
For sure. And kind of the thing also to keep in mind is that we can definitely see that with the use of the internet and especially artificial intelligence, it has allowed artists to start evolving to another form. We have a lot more control than we've ever had in history. Like, try to go back to an author or a poet from 1972, and you tell her that you just published your own book and you've been able to, she's going to look at you like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah, like no, and I went for hybrid publishing for a reason, because like, no, I don't think any traditional publisher would have accepted my book as the thing. Well, one, because when I started, that's not what it was going to be. It ended up in the process becoming something else. But like, it doesn't have a genre. And so they wouldn't know how to sell it, because it doesn't, it is a memoir, but it's also poetry, but it's also kind of self-help, but it's also, you know, it's like, it's a bunch of things. It's also an art book. And so I think they would have been like, I don't know what this is. And I was able to just do what I felt was right and not have anybody tell me that it was right or wrong. And I could design it how I wanted. And I could, you know, it was like, I had every yeah, full creative control. And I had support, and I had a brilliant coach who worked in traditional publishing. And so she was able to see things in me that I didn't see in myself. Like the poetry thing wouldn't have happened had I not gone or worked with her, because she was just like, what do you think about poetry? And like, I immediately started crying when she said that. And I was like, yeah, I never told her. I was like, I didn't tell you that. Like, I literally wrote hundreds of poems when I was a kid. Like, that's all I wrote. So I still have them. I have wrote so many poems, but I haven't since. And it was like she saw something. And then we started to think about, okay, where do we add poems? And I went back and read things I already wrote. And I'm like, wait, this is a poem I already wrote. All I needed to do is like format it differently. Like, there was already poems in there. And she was like, yeah, I know. That's why I said it. She was like, you write like a poet. And I was like, oh. Wow. So I wouldn't have noticed that.
I love that.
All it is, add a couple enters a few times, oh, and I'm God. Like, oh, look, we have a poem already. So it was cool. Like, it was just a really exciting process.
The really cool thing, though, about especially poetry is poetry in itself has even created its own genres. You know, like, think about, like, people kind of forget this. Rap is music, but the actual, like, you know, rap itself is poetry.
Yeah.
So it's basically you're doing a poem to a background music. That's kind of how it formed and evolved. And like, you don't believe me, listen to like Nas, you know, like Deep Mob, like MC Hammer. They all sound like that, because like, that's what it was. And it's really cool, because like, you sit there, you're like, wow. Like, you're hearing this poem and you're hearing this music, and you're just like, you're kind of like in this like trance. It's kind of the same thing like what you're doing over here. It's like where you're like, ooh, this art. And like, you're looking at the poem and you're like, ooh. It's basically a meld of two art forms. It allows people to have an interaction with it in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah, because there was this one chapter, when it came up, is I was writing a chapter about the chapter, like the theme-ish is like learning to feel my feelings, right? I was stuffing a lot of stuff down, and it was causing a lot of like migraines and like itching and all this stuff. And I was talking to my coach, Heather, and I was like, I don't know how to write a chapter about this. I was like, it happened internally and it happened over a period of like 4 years. There's no story. It's just, I kind of like incrementally worked on it in my brain, you know, I'm like in my body, in my brain. And she, and I was like, how do you explain a feeling with words? And, and I was like, oh, that's what art is. Like, that's what artists do. They just explain things without words. And I was like, and that's what poetry is. And that's like, you use words with poetry, obviously, but you don't have to have like a narrative, or you don't have to have like all the extra filler words. You can just like boil the feeling down into an essence and then capture that. And so that entire chapter ended up being only poems because there was no story. It was just something I kind of worked on. And so that's really how it came about.
Sorry if I keep on going back to this, but like, I just think immediately of like Ice Cube, because the type of rap that he put out, you know, the type of poetry that he wrote was very like direct, and it felt very strong, but it wasn't supposed to be literal. He was just telling you and how he felt in that moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that, by the way, touching on this, because this is an issue that I've noticed, is where people get too literal with things. It's like, don't read in too much. It's like, you know, looking at the signs, it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's like, dude, it's just a sign, okay? It's just a freaking sign. Like, calm down.
Yeah. But, well, I think too, yeah, like what's so exciting about looking at art, listening to music, watching theater, reading a book, any engaging in any art form, what you're doing is using it as what you're doing, like naturally and subconsciously, is you're using it as a metaphor for your own life. Like, you're looking for yourself in it. I think people are like just naturally inclined to do that. And so you have to, I think, I lost the thought, but it was like something about metaphor. Yeah, I don't know.
Are you having
I feel like
a
I got the thought out, but like it just didn't have an ending. That was just it.
Oh. did you have a stoner moment?
I did. I'm not stoned because it was only 9 o'clock in the morning. Last time I was, and then it didn't work out. But I did have a really... I invented that night that we were supposed to have the podcast. I invented sorting paper by color. When you didn't show up, I was just like, we just had a scheduling snafu. And I invented sorting paper by color. And I was like, I thought I was the smartest person in the world. So I do appreciate that. And now I have here some fold. Look at this. There's red. Oh, wow. And all my red papers are in there. Ugh.
Oh my God.
It was life-changing that
you're
night.
You're killing. Honey, you're like giving, you're going to be giving some people like a little, you know, like, oh, the sorted papers. You know, it's like that ASMR video, but it's like the sorted papers.
Ooh, yeah, I should make a video about my sorted papers.
Yes. This should be a next, you know, viral thing. Listen, you know, Stanley Cups can be a viral thing. You know, let's make papers a viral thing. Before you know it, you hear like, Walmart is going crazy. People are coming to buy colored papers by storms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously, that's the world we're living in. You literally can just be like, here's a paper clip, you know, and it's like it survived. I don't know, ants, you know, it survived the ants, but like literally that's like what you're dealing with. You could literally like come up with anything. Like, you can be so creative as a writer that like you can make anything go viral, and just people will just pay $80 in droves.
I think there is like a golden paperclip you can buy online that's like $100. Like, I do think that does exist.
Jesus.
I don't remember where. Oh, now I'm going to Google it.
Yeah, let's double do this so we can see if we can find this.
There was like some really expensive paperclip. Where was it?
It's expensive.
It was like real gold, though. Real gold paperclip.
I've seen the most expensive stapler. There was a stapler that I saw that was like made out of like sterling silver and like diamonds and like rubies.
Wow.
Insane.
Oh, here's one on Etsy. 14K gold paperclip, $220.
Oh my God.
There's a one from Tiffany & Company, $1,800 that's used on eBay.
Yeah,
so it must have been Tiffany &
Company. It's Tiffany & Company.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still want a Tiffany's. Like, I'm nuts. I'm like one of those people, if I want an engagement ring, I want it to be Tiffany's. Because one of my all-time favorite movies is Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just like thing baked in my. You see, this is what they do. You know, they start the propaganda like fucking 75 years ago. You know, you're like, here.
Yeah, but you're going to get your ring from there. And then your wedding's going to have like the Tiffany blue box, like color scheme.
Oh my God. Oh. They charge so much for that color. You have no idea. It's nuts. It's like that color is always like an additional $50 more.
Yeah.
You ever like check paint supplies online? I'm serious. You'll see the Tiffany's color is always more expensive because they own that color.
I don't. How do you own a color? That's wild.
Isn't that crazy? They own that color.
It's a beautiful color.
It is. Really
is. I'm looking at it now with the gold paperclip on the background.
Can I afford the $1,500?
I would lose it like in a second. What do you do with it?
Exactly. Well, right. What would you do with like, 15? What?
What papers are that important that you need to clip? I don't know. I could use it as a bookmark in my book, but.
I mean, maybe unless like you hate your partner that much. You're like, here. You're like, what? Well, I was thinking of a ring, but this was cheaper.
You're rich enough to afford it, but it can still be a burn. Yeah.
I honestly think the richest thing I've ever seen before, and I saw this in person, was a guy that opens an automatic door for a Maybach Mercedes. So basically, the guy gets at the door opens automatically. The guy puts out his hand, and he has a guy that holds his hand and helps him out. And he's like in his 30s. So I was like, wait a minute, wait. Hold on. Your car has an automatic door, but you hire somebody to help you out of the car. What?
Was the rich guy driving the car? The guy that was helping him out, was he the driver?
I'm assuming.
Probably.
So keep in mind, when I got there, this was in New York City. I was like walking past, but yeah. I was like slowly. I was like, what? Okay. Cool.
Wow. I wouldn't want that. Like, that's too many people in my life. I don't need extra people. Like,
no.
I guess if they were doing stuff for me, maybe. But even then, I feel like they would just be in the way. But if they were providing things for me, food and things, that might be good.
Isn't it amazing how we have gotten to a point where a $1,500 paperclip could be a practical item for somebody? I'm not kidding. There are people out there.
Do you think it's a practical item for someone, whoever bought this?
Think about it. If somebody's worth $5 billion.
Right.
They can buy like 100 of them.
They could. It's pocket change for them. You know, and as I've made more money in my life, like things that used to be luxurious are now inexpensive. Like Taco Bell at one point in my life was like, that's all I could afford to eat. And it was amazing. Like when I get the sour cream on the Taco Bell, like that was mind blowing. Now I can't even stomach Taco Bell. Like I don't want to eat it. But back then, like when I could afford the sour cream, like that was really exciting. So I maybe at one point in my life, like this book blows up, like let's like Eat, Pray, Love or something. Maybe I can afford
$1,500.
I wouldn't though. I would maybe like give that to a poor person. I don't know.
And be like, here, put it in their pocket. You know, like hold on.
Give them the paperclip. No, I would give them the money. Yeah, buy them the paperclip. Here you go.
That That would be all. Can you, that would be terrible.
That's so mean. God. That'd be awful.
I mean, like, especially the guys like in Skid Row, like my man, like there'd be like 100 eyes just.
We're all about the artist. That is the whole purpose of this podcast, period. And you have a really valuable tool. You can share this with artists, people that are creative, someone that can enjoy this podcast and really enjoy the experience of Lost in the Groove. So with that, let's jump back to today's episode, shall we?
Like, shit, he's gonna have to run, you know, like be like fucking OJ Simpson 1993 all over again. It's like, there's a man in Skid Row running for his life. There's 100 people going after him because of a $1,500 paper. What? A $1,500 paper clip? Jeez.
Oh.
I love this conversation, boy. I have to say, like, this is fucking awesome. Man. Oh my God.
The mental picture is just really, it's really great.
You know, I was talking with somebody the other day because there's this thing about becoming famous. Mm-hmm. And I try to look at it as look at most people today that are very famous, like Dave Chappelle, you know, Joe Rogan, Howard Stern, fucking Mick Jagger. I don't know. There's a bunch of people.
Insert some women's names as well. Go ahead.
Trying to think. Gwyneth Paltrow. Okay. Whoopi Goldberg. Actually, you know what? Whoopi Goldberg is a great example of this. Whoopi was very unsuccessful for a very long time of her life. And even when she was on Star Trek, okay? She was on Star Trek. She still wasn't being paid the same level as other members of the cast. And try to understand that even people that do become famous, it's not always what they wanted. Some of them just wanted to have for themselves a career, you know? And then you have to ask yourself the question, is that really what you want to do? Or do you really just want to be a successful artist? Maybe you're not famous, but other people can appreciate you later on, you know, when you reach a certain point, you know, and they can read your books and stuff. Just like Freddie Mercury, David Bowie, John Lennon, Whitney Houston, you know, for example, like she's gone, but you can still listen to all of her music. Donna Summer.
I think it is fascinating to think about, like, you know, famous actors, famous musicians, like a lot of them, I'm just guessing. I honestly have no idea, but like, I bet most of them just like didn't do it to become famous. They did it because like they love to act and that's their art form. And like to act, like you might get famous. To be successful in your art form is then to be famous.
It is a possibility, but I don't think that should be. For me personally, I don't feel like that's something that you should drive towards, because all that does is added stress and anxiety, you know. And you're like, "Why are my followers' numbers low?" Like, you know what? I'm like, bro, stop it. Sit down, fucking smoke a joint, drink, you know, Sunny D, be quiet.
Well, and have you read Dave Grohl's autobiography? The storyteller?
No, but I've seen parts of his interview. Oh my God.
So good. I listened to it. And what was really fascinating about that for me is, one, he's an amazing writer. Like, I was in the middle of writing a book at the time. So I was just like, every book I read, I was like studying the writing, but like
getting inspiration.
His writing was incredible. But I saw myself in him in that, like, his desire was not to be it was not to be a famous musician. It was, he had it in his body and his soul and his mind to create art, to create music and to tell stories with his music. And like, it was just in him and it always was in him. And he just had this drive to do it. And like, and then he like made choices based on like, he was offered a job as the drummer for Tom Petty, and he was like, this would be like a perfect easy life with this like chill band that like doesn't have any drama, and I could be like have a family. And but he was like, but that doesn't like fuel his like art. He didn't fuel him artistically. So that's, so it was like at the time when he was creating Foo Fighters, or he was writing the first album. And I was like, he just has this desire to tell stories and make music. And that's what it felt like the book came from too. Like, I think it was during COVID that he wrote it, cause it was, I guess he couldn't perform anymore, but you know, it just really was amazing that desire artists have. It's not about the fame. And you can kind of tell the ones where it is about the fame. And yeah. There's just like this ickiness about them. And it's really fascinating. And then another big magic moment, like that book I love, but she talks about how, you know, she had Eat, Pray, Love, which was like, you know, she sold millions of copies. Julia Roberts played her in a movie. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I watched it. It was amazing. Yeah.
The book is, I listened to the book to sleep. Like, I love, I did, her voice is so soothing. But she was like, you know, I wrote that book and then I wrote another one. And then I wrote another one and I wrote, you know, she was like, it's, and it wasn't about like, I now have to make one that is as good as the last one. It's just, I have this need to write. I have this need to create and I'm going to keep creating. So. And sorry, one more thing. I'm like, I'm a monologue here. Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, like never wrote another book after that. It was like super, super like big book, very, you know, popular. What's the right word for a book that gets, I don't know. But anyway, it was like a hit. And then she never wrote another one. Yeah.
Oh,
one hit wonder. Yeah. And it's like, but she didn't even try to write anymore. And it's like, was it because, and I don't know, I haven't like researched her, but like, was it because she didn't think she could live up to the last one?
I think because the book in itself, Killing of a Mockingbird, was so controversial at the time.
Yeah.
That, you know, we were touching on this earlier. Authors and writers of the past were controlled by an iron fist. They were controlled by either the Democrats, yeah. They were either controlled by the Republicans. They were always controlled by some sort of an agenda. So if you were in a, you know, an exploratory artist in any shape or form in that time, they would go after you. And they would make sure to ruin and destroy your career as best as they can.
That's a good point. I bet she got, I experienced this just running a business online. You know, it's so easy for people to just criticize you for things. And like that, if you're not, it's hard to deal with that. Even if you get like lots of positive feedback, you get one bad one and it just like sinks you down. My podcast has one bad review and it's like, it says, I'm authoritarian and not open-minded to other people's beliefs. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, that's not true. And so I went back and I was like, okay, this review was on June 2020. Oh, that was after my episode about how we need, like, it was about Black Lives Matter. I did an episode about like that. And so that person did not, you know, was not, it was a kind of conservative person. So then I became an unwelcoming space for her. And I was like, okay, I'll accept this bad review. That's fine.
Do you know how many? It's kind of funny because, like, I'm a libertarian, not politically, but whenever I tell people I'm a libertarian, you know what the first thing they tell me? Oh, you're a liberal. I'm like, okay, I'm a libertarian, which means that I'm nor liberal nor conservative.
I think it's a circle because I've met people who were like so far liberal that they became libertarian. And then I've met people who were so far conservative that they became libertarian. And so it's like,
there's two
it's
sides.
A very confusing. Yeah. It's a very confusing.
So there's with libertarian, the way that I tell, sorry, no. The way that I tell people is that there are libertarians that are swing more towards conservative. And then there are libertarians that swing more towards liberal. I'm the type that swings more towards liberal, but what's very thing, what's what, the hardest thing for me was to be able to be open and be able to say my feelings and opinions on this podcast and not feel like, you know, I'm entitled to feel the way that I feel, you know, like. Can I say that the fact that I'm a Jew and the fact that I'm gay and the fact that I'm also mixed, my father was Moroccan and my mom was white, that I have certain leeways with certain things? Yes, that is true, because I can talk on those conversations. I have personal experience from those things. But I have every right to. I'm American. I have the free right to speak. You know, it's somebody be saying like, you're an authoritarian. Who the fuck are you? You have a right to be an authoritarian. Like, get the hell out of here.
Like, yes. Literally my space. You.
Do you want to, I'll tell you something. I had a guest, we had a makeup artist that we were going to bring onto the podcast. And I have family that lives in Israel. And she basically like messaged me like a day or two before. She's like, oh, I'm not going to be able to make the podcast. I was like, okay, so when do you want to reschedule? And she was like, oh, yeah, that's not going to be necessary. And I said, okay, is there a problem? And she says, well, yes, it's because you support Israel. And because you support Israel, that means that you're a bad person. And therefore, I can't talk with somebody such as yourself. So this isn't going to work out. Now, let me explain something. I lived in Israel. I worked with Palestinians. I was in the West Bank. I've been all over Israel. And I don't condemn Palestinians. I don't condemn Israelis either. They're both civilians living in one country. I've been there. I have family there. And I'm not here to support anybody's side. I'm just here telling you about my family and my situation that I was living there. Why is that like, out of almost 200 episodes, I have published interviews with dozens of people. That's what you go back to? That's the only thing out of all the work that I've done as an artist and creator that you focus on. Crazy. Yeah,
it is. And it's like, okay.
I know, I opened a real big can of worms.
No, I'm like, what I'm comparing to is like this, I'm like, so, like, if I was going to have someone on my podcast and then I learned that they're like anti-gay or like have made like terrible comments about trans people online, I'm going to cancel that interview, right? I'm just like, I don't need to give them a platform. You know, I don't need to get them more followers. But I'm like, but in this case, it's different because it's like, it's, you know, you have a real lived experience of it. Oh, that's fascinating. So it's like, it's such a, I feel like there's a lot of issues where I would do that. Like if I had found out that you were like, so I guess it just depends. I guess everyone has their limits, their border. They're like, okay, they're like black and white beliefs.
See, that's the opposite of an open-minded perspective, because I'm the type of person where I actually, like, for example, I interviewed an anarchist on my podcast.
Yeah.
And that was definitely an experience for me, because here's the thing. Sometimes the most valuable conversations will be the people that you disagree with the most.
Yeah.
And it's strange in how, like, we live now where we can't even sit down and have different beliefs and talk openly about them, you know, and be able to, like, sit down and say, okay, why do you feel this way? You know, how is that making you feel? It always comes back to, like, no, you are, you know, racist, you're a phobic, you are... We're going to cancel you. We don't want you to have a platform. Instead of just having that open conversation, you know, and figuring out, like, what's going on here? You know, why do you feel this way? Like, why do you understand
you know, like the history or the understanding or the philosophy. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. Yeah. I know this is very deep.
No, I'm very early for the morning. I know. I'm like, no, this is the conversation I like to have. Yeah, that's a good point. I think too, though, I wonder too that it's like my brain will find the words in just a second. To me, there are some issues that are basic, they're basic human rights things. And so, like, okay, I'm not going to name particular.
You can if you want to.
Family members. But this particular family member is not going to be listening to this podcast. But, you know, like an older member of my husband's family who has used the N-word in front of my children, who has, after the 2020 election, screwed a Trump poster into the wall of the garage, like permanently, you know, like it was after the election was over, and has made derogatory remarks about gay people and my presence too. And every time I'm like, don't talk like that in front of me and my family. And I don't want to have a conversation with him about this. Like, I'm not going to change any minds. I don't believe it's a point of view worth entertaining.
Because the thing is, you're dealing with somebody that's closed. You know, yeah. For example, if you're going to have a conversation with somebody from an opposite point of view, they have to be also open to be able to hear what you're telling them. You know, I'll give you a great example. I work in a kitchen in a brewery, and I work with two people, even my boss, that are both Trump supporters. You know, me personally, I don't believe in presidential campaigns. I believe the whole thing is bullshit. But I'm one of those people that, like, I don't hate or love the guy because I don't work for him and I don't really know him. I can kind of give you my point on things that I've seen that he's done, such as Home Alone 2, which he was excellent in, by the way. But that's as far as it, but you know, that's what I'm trying to say is that, like, you can live, again, artistically, creatively, you can be around people of different beliefs and opinions than yourself.
Yeah.
If you're willing to be open. And again, like, this all comes back to that negative comment of you can have that if it's open on both sides. It's just not how people work.
Yeah. And the person who canceled on you didn't realize that you are open and that you're willing to talk about it all. Because I have friends who have differing political views than me, different like religious beliefs, but we respect each other's beliefs and we can talk about them and we can, you know, we can share, you know, we can question them without it being an attack, or, you know, we can have conversations like that. But yeah, there are some people you can't do that with. So I think it's kind of like a protective mechanism too.
Isn't it, you know, I wanted to touch on this because you're talking about that family member, you know, that was using like derogatory terms. It's so interesting in how like we're still at a point where race is still a conversation. You know, like try to understand, like, even in like the Latin community, okay, like how is race even a question? It's like, hello, you all fucking moved to Florida, all right? Some of you are screwing other versions of like Ecuadorians, you know, people from Colombia, people from Venezuela. Like, people just gotta understand, like, we're all different colors of eggs in the basket. It's like, we're all, it's like this whole, it drives me nuts. We're all diverse in culture. You're diverse in culture, even though, you know, you're, I don't know what your background is. You're Scandinavian, European.
Yeah, I think it's like Northern European. I did my 23andMe.
Okay.
But that mostly is Europe, Austria,
but that
Poland.
Is
But that is diverse culture. That is racial culture. That is what we are as people, is that we're different races, we're different ethnic backgrounds, we have different... This whole idea of like, okay, can't we gotta like take you and put you on the top because you're Indian.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. My grandparents, both of my grandmothers on two sides, one is Polish. She like was born there. And then the other one is Irish. They hated each other because I think it was the Irish one who hated the Polish one because she was Polish. And I was like, that's weird. But I don't know.
But that's a great example of how far we've gone as people. It's like we forget that we spent the entire 60s, 70s, and 80s getting away from segregation, getting away from this idea of, we still have problems with minority communities. We still have problems with crime and unsafe housing. These are still issues that we deal with. However, we are more diverse than we ever have been before. And this whole like equality of the race doesn't make any sense, because you can be a really successful and creative artist and give over that diversity from, you know, your poetry or artistry. And it doesn't matter who you are or your Polish or Irish background.
Yeah.
But
I had a situation. I run this program. It's called the Art Connection Circle. And we basically I put up a work of art and then we all kind of talk about it, interpret it, and talk about like how we see ourselves in it or whatever. And I had one person who joined the program who the painting was a Frida Kahlo painting. And, you know, Frida Kahlo was Mexican, but she was also a woman. She was also, you know, she was also queer. She was also like, she had gone through a divorce. She'd gone through this like cheating husband. Like she all had these like life experiences. She reflects them in her art.
But this she person died came young. In the program.
Yeah. She was in this accident. She was disabled. Like there's all these things that we could all relate to in different ways. Right.
Right.
But
right,
this
right.
One woman came in and she was like, we can't do this because we're not of her culture. We can't interpret her art and see ourselves in it. And I was like,
oh my God,
why did you join this program? One, a program dedicated to interpreting art. But she was like adamant and she kept calling her Frida Kahlo, which she drove me crazy because I'm like, you're not even saying her name right. But yeah. And I was like, no, no, she painted her full human experience on her canvases, and she let it all out. And as a woman, I see myself in a lot of her work. Like I get it. I can see her pain. And it's like, because I'm not Mexican doesn't mean that I can't, I'm not saying her.
It means that it doesn't mean that you're not welcome to their culture and their artistry. It's like where you have every right to experience Mexican art and culture. You have every right to experience African or, for example, Caribbean art and culture. Because
I'm not saying my view is better. I'm not saying like because I'm interpreting it, then now like I'm diminishing her Mexicanness.
You're allowed to be inspired. You're allowed to be inspired and make something like you said, being celebrating her life, her creativity, like what you took from it. Isn't that what we as artists do, is we take from other artists, create from that, and make something new from it?
That's the definition of creativity. Yeah. You take all your influences and you make something new from them.
Honey, I feel like we're the ones that are keeping this world together. You know,
indeed.
It's like, damn, imagine if there's no artists. It's like one day it's like, all right, all artists, we're getting you on the rocket ship, taking you all of Earth. And shit, man, Earth would look like oatmeal and bland almonds. Like, we wouldn't even recognize it anymore.
Dang. Our world would be amazing, though. Like, wherever we're headed on this plane or this this rocket ship, like...
There'll be, like, sci-fi disco parties, you know, until, like, 2 a.m. in the morning, like... You know, like, all the beds are vibrating on all the floors. Like, damn, they're partying hard. But it's true, though. I feel that in many ways, one of the things that have kept us alive and thankful and being able to, you know, it's interesting because before the pandemic, there was 9/11, you know, and that I wasn't old enough to remember this, but before, after 9/11, the experience.
Hold on, your audio cut out. I wonder if it's my headphones.
Hold on.
Let me take them off.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Wait. Oh, yep. Now I can. I think my headphones died.
All right. So basically, when you're dealing with the pandemic, what basically has happened is we've had the opposite effect. People have become more distant. You know, people are not as interactive. People are more through the social media and text messaging versus actually physically being there with people. And I feel that podcasts and artists such as yourself, you know, making new forms of writing, filmmaking, whatever it may be that tickles your subconscious. It all ties back to a way of being able to be more connected as people than ever we had before.
Yeah.
So, damn. Have we been doing this for over an hour?
Yeah.
Jeez Louise. Well, this has been fun.
Yeah.
Question for you. Where can these wonderful people find your socials, your website?
Yeah. You can find me at cindyingram.com. And again, the book is Art is About Being Whole.
Okay.
Is the name of it. You can find it on my website if you want a signed copy, but it's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. And all my social links are on there, but it's just I'm most active on Facebook and Instagram, and I'm just dabbling in TikTok. But all those links are on my website.
Perfect. Do you have any book signings coming up, or?
No, I haven't scheduled any, but I've thought maybe I should do that. So
okay.
Well, if you ever plan, I'll be like, today's the day.
Yeah,
I'll schedule that.
Well, if you ever plan on doing one out here in Florida, specifically Fort Lauderdale, just
okay.
You know, just let me know.
I will.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Well, listen. You want to check out a good read and a new form and creativity of writing? Be sure to check out Cindy. And want to check out more of the podcast? You can find us on Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Lost the Group Pod. With that. Catch you on the next one. Get out of here.